You're listening to Clinical Conversations, brief talks with people shaping the future of clinical medicine. I'm Joe Elia, and I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Danielle Scherer of the Medical University of South Carolina. Hi, Danielle.
Hi.
This week's conversation is about one of the foundational skills of clinical medicine, listening to the patient. Specifically, listening in order to sort out the patient's treatment preferences in an era when treatment options are multiplying fast. Our guests are authors of a British Medical Journal essay on making what they call a preference diagnosis, the process of figuring out what the patient's preferences for treatment are after the clinical diagnosis is made and helping the patient to sort through those options. Glenn Elwin is a clinician and a visiting professor at the Dartmouth Center for Healthcare Delivery Science in Hanover, New Hampshire. When not visiting here, he's a research professor at Cardiff University in Wales. Chris Trimble is an adjunct professor at the Dartmouth Center. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Professor Elwin, I'd like to start by asking how you and your co-authors got interested in this concept of preference diagnosis, and if you would also give your estimate of how often you think clinicians miss making that diagnosis.
This is a tough one, but I'll tell you how I got interested. I mean, I've been working in this field for probably about 10 years. I'm a family doctor, but I've been for a long time interested in involving patients, informing them about tough decisions. Many people may have heard the term shared decision-making, and in fact, I've been using that for almost a decade. But I kind of found that didn't go down so well with clinicians. So what I felt was maybe important is to try and put this issue of trying to understand what matters most to patients in a more of a professional framework. And we know that doctors really care about diagnosis. So I just wondered whether or not they might be really interested in becoming experts on diagnosing people's preferences as well as their illness, and knowing actually that where they themselves would be patients, they would want their own preferences taken account of. And so we've been just using this term as a way to make this more more of a thing that you would take pride in to be a great diagnostician, both of treatment issues and preferences. So that's how we've got into this use of the term, if you like. It's really involving and informing patients, being in that way aligned. And it's been a tough journey. It's not easy. In terms of how often this happens, I think probably more often than we dare to think. Many doctors like to think they know what their patients like, but there's a lot of evidence, actually, and we could go into that in more detail, showing that there are many assumptions made, that when you really ask, you get surprised about the different kind of preferences people have.
This is Danielle Scherer. Now, do you think it's that we as clinicians don't try hard enough to figure out what their preferences are, or do you think we're sort of limited in our skill set at seeking that information?
Well, I'm not sure if it's that we don't try hard. Sometimes I think we're not always curious about those preferences, and we've also done quite a bit of work as to how willing are patients to express their true views about this and to ask questions. And what we've found, we've published some work on this recently in Health Affairs, is that patients are actually quite reluctant to use their voice and to express their preferences in case they upset the doctors or regarded as awkward patients or difficult patients. So I think it does take a new skill to become curious. And also the other issue is that we don't really want people's initial preferences. We want to know their preferences when they've become better informed about stuff, about the possible harms, the possible disadvantages of going down the line of treatment. And it takes time to inform people well and give them risk information. And that's a skill set that I think is new to many clinicians.
It's skill and time, I guess, is the other major barrier.
Yeah.
I think in terms of skill, it's important to point out that this is not a skill that doctors have needed in the past. It's only because we've seen such a rapid proliferation of treatment options in the last couple of decades that preference diagnosis becomes so relevant in so many situations. It's not part of the culture of medicine. It's not something doctors are trained to do. It is a new skill that must be learned.
Right, because you're giving them so many options now. You don't want to completely overwhelm them with the palette of potential options for any one diagnosis. So you sort of, I guess, have to balance that.
I think that's right. I like to use the term reasonable options of what a reasonable patient would like to hear about. And also, you can't explain all the risks and benefits to the nth degree. It would take too long. But there are some issues that make a material difference to what you would choose if you were well-informed. The kind of, in prostate cancer, for example, some people would really worry about losing their potency or becoming possibly incontinent, having surgery, where that surgery may not be necessary. It's perfectly reasonable to watch and wait or to have a chemotherapy in some situations. So we know from the use of decision support tools, decision aids, that many patients, about 40%, make different decisions when they become better informed. And there are many trials in the systematic review that's been done in Ottawa that shows this fairly clearly.
Yeah, and I guess that those really are powerful statistics, I think, for clinicians, is that they really can make a big difference in the outcome just based on giving them appropriate information and giving them, just like you said, a reasonable number of options, or what the options would be for a patient on the bell curve. The other thing, in your article, you talk about good old Osler, the dictum that we're all supposed to live by, which is listen to your patient. And somehow we probably lost sight of that in a number of different ways, including what you're calling diagnostic preference. Do you think it's that we're so concentrated on the objective things, the lab findings and the imaging results, that we just get short-sighted on this basic dictum that I feel like we've lost?
Well, I think, in fact, the reason Osler put such an emphasis on listening to the patient is because all those lab tests and imaging technologies didn't exist way back then. And so new technologies have eliminated some of the need to listen, at least when making a medical diagnosis. But there is no substitute for listening when making a preference diagnosis. It's all about figuring out what your patient values, how they prioritize the various possible outcomes. And there's no MRI scanner that can tell you that.
How can clinicians get better at making a preference diagnosis? You point to the use of option grids. And when we covered your essay in Physicians First Watch, we pointed to the URL where is it? It's at University of at Cardiff University.
Yes.
So, but are there other places that they can go to improve their skills at preference diagnosis?
Yes, I think there are. Those are examples of what we call short tools for use inside the clinical encounter, and we've got a lot of interest in being able to convey the information in a GIST format, so that it's not too much information, it's one page, and you're able to compare against the options. There are other longer tools. The Foundation for Informed Medical Decision-Making in Boston has made DVDs for many years, and many people are interested in those. There are also the beginnings of some courses that develop these skills, and you'll hear of them as shared decision-making skills. But as I said earlier, I think one of the difficulties about that is that that isn't so palatable, I think, to many clinicians, in terms of the term is a bit strange, and also the idea that you might share your decision as an expert with a patient, that doesn't seem to resonate very well with the clinical body. What there are, however, some evidence that we're doing a trial of these short tools at the moment is that by just figuring out and placing the comparison of options, which are reasonable, in front of patients and having that conversation, is that the skill set is not that difficult, actually. It's everybody is familiar with trying to choose a house to live or a holiday to go to, but you need the information that's very transparent and very easy to convey to the patient. And once you've got that information on your desk, it makes the task easier. What makes comparing option extremely difficult if you're confabulating or trying to make it up or trying to memorize something that you can't really memorize very well.
So if I could add to that, Glenn is focusing on diagnosing preference in an encounter between a doctor and a patient. But doctors can also get better by examining and demanding more data about what patients want on average. Some of the past research that we highlighted in the paper showed some pretty amazing gaps between what patients want and what doctors think patients want. And one way to close that gap is one patient at a time, but the other way is through data gathering on what patients want. So at least we're closer on average.
Right.
An
example of that, Chris, is breast conservation in women with breast cancer. And you quote somebody's numbers as physicians think that women value conservation of the breast above all else about 75% of the time. But actually, when you ask patients about that, it's about really 10% of the time. I think maybe the implication of that is they're more interested in survival than in keeping the breast. Is that a fair observation?
That's a fair observation. In fact, I shared that statistic with my sister, and she responded, well, of course, because most doctors are men. so maybe there's a gender gap that helps explain the differences between what patients want and what doctors think patients want. I don't know.
Well, but we have a good example of this in prostate cancer, though. I mean, where, you know, if it's true that most doctors are men, and they won't be for very long, I think. You know, when you're trying to decide what your treatment course will be, if you have a prostate cancer, then that would be a fertile ground for new information, to collect new information. Is there a system around that you're aware of that collects those kinds of patient preferences? I think of some of the Scandinavian countries and actually in the UK, where they're, you know, national medical databases are really national treasures, but they don't collect that kind of information, do they?
No, they don't. We're very interested in this area, as you can imagine, here at Dartmouth, and we've got ideas about how we might do this. There isn't really a systematic way that anybody's developed of doing this, and there is a difference, again, between somebody's initial preference and the preference that they hold when they've become well-informed, and I think the distinction between those two is very important. What I'm also fascinated by is the kind of preferences that medical professionals might have. Because we know that there are some studies and some fascinating studies that clinicians and doctors are prepared to recommend things to patients that they might not take for themselves.
You know, it does seem like from a time perspective, as we mentioned, that, I mean, it's in my mind, it's kind of like informed consent for the diagnosis piece. So it should and can be very time-consuming to make sure and validate that the patient understands the risks and benefits, just like you're saying, of going forward with, you know, treatment A or treatment B. But it does seem like, as we've seen with informed consent, if you do it well at the front end, it does seem like you should save both the patient and the provider time and energy at the back end if it's done well to begin with. So there's not, some of the examples, as you mentioned in your article, are, you know, the patient who, you know, has a treatment done and then has sincere regret later that, you know, she pursued that path.
Yes, that's right. There is great interest in two major benefits, litigation benefits. We're doing a review at the moment as to the prediction that litigation rates would be less if people diagnose preferences well. And the second thing is, which is the policy interest, of course, is that ethically it's the right thing to do and might even then lead to cost benefits, so that people are more conservative when they become well-informed and therefore take up voluntarily less invasive or less costly treatments. So those are big wins, in fact.
And you also mentioned the role of other clinicians as being good sources of information about patient preferences. Tell us a little bit more about, you know, how a clinician should use their other, you know, nurses or physical therapists or social workers or, you know, other clinical perspectives when they're trying to seek out alternative sources of what the patient's preferences might be.
Well, you yourself mentioned that one of the major constraints here is simply physician time. And one of the ways to leverage physician time is to get other people involved in gathering information from the patient about what they value. And that who those other providers might be depends on the context. Could be a nurse, could be a decision coach, could be a social worker. But anybody who could bring insight to the table about what a patient's priorities are. And as Glenn's research pointed out, that might be much more comfortable for a patient to openly discuss their preferences with a social worker, whereas they might be very intimidated to do so with a doctor. Mm-hmm. Would you think a team approach to preference diagnosis is a strong one?
How would you ask clinicians? I know, Chris, that you have done some work on behavioral change and so... How would you go about approaching a cultural change in medicine? For instance, what would you ask clinicians to do next week that they weren't doing last week?
Well, I think behavior change very often starts with a performance challenge. And what we're really doing here is raising the bar for physicians. And we're saying to the best of them, you are already world-class medical diagnosticians, but your job is now harder. You have to be just as good at diagnosing preference as you are at diagnosing disease. And we think that doctors are professionals that love to rise to challenges. So the first thing we do is set it out there, and the best will rise and meet that challenge.
So it's sort of like informed consent. In the sense that the patient is getting information and the clinician then is at risk for having his or her pet solutions ignored by the patient. And that's a loss of control on the clinician's part, isn't it?
I would worry if we portray this as a better way of doing informed consent. There is a kind of power dynamic here. People are becoming more informed anyway because of the information age that we're in. But they're also distrusting professionals more than they used to. I think we have to be almost respectful of people's views and preferences as they entertain the complex technologies that medicine now has to offer. And I think the kind of the way through this is to almost to say that any treatment that hasn't got the assent and the affirmation of the patient that fits with what matters most to them, their goals in life, the way they live their life, is probably not going to work, that people are not going to take it. And if a procedure is done that they regret later, that's going to open up the road to litigation and complaints. So in a way, it's probably about saying to the medical profession, the patient's preference is just as important as your expertise, and it's your role to do that combination.
I see.
So I'd simply like to add that preference diagnosis is not unique to medicine. It is, studied lots of other industries, and it's a part and parcel to many more. Financial advice is another area where preference diagnosis is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more recognized in that industry that that's a big part of the game. Nobody would take advice from the world's best stock picker if that stock picker didn't at least ask you a few questions about your financial goals and your risk tolerance.
Okay.
And so we're just transferring that same challenge, figuring out what your customer wants, to medicine, and in that context, it's best called a preference diagnosis.
All right, Chris. Well, thank you for that. And Glenn, I want to thank you as well for spending time with us today.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was our 159th edition. All the earlier ones may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch, whose website is jwatch, that's jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Dr. Danielle Shurer and I thank you for listening.